Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Left of Straight Show with your host, Scott Fullerton, as we discuss everything under the rainbow sun, from LGBT issues to foodies, entertainment to books. Join us as we talk to some of the most interesting leaders and celebrity LGBT guests and allies on the internet. So grab a cocktail, it's always happy hour somewhere, and enjoy the show. Now, here's your host, Scott Fullerton.
Howdy, howdy, everybody. Welcome to the Left of Straight Show. It is Monday, February 6th. Hope you all had a great weekend. I sure did. Welcome to the show, guys. Got some great stuff for you today. Of course, I know you guys all probably are super bowled out for at least the halftime show. We'll talk about that for a couple seconds. And then we're going to bring on as our my special guest today, Adam Davenport. He's an actor, model, music artist, producer and writer. He's got a new single, electronic dance music single, that you're just going to love. So we're going to have him on in just a couple of minutes. Of course, we had last week, if you missed any of our shows last week, check them out in the free app. You go on your iPhone or Android or tablet, go to your app store, type in Left of Straight Radio, and it's a free app. You'll never miss an episode of any of our shows right here on Left of Straight Radio. So check that out. Tomorrow we're going to have trans activist Scott Turner Schofield and out singer Preston Wiggins. And on Wednesday, we're going to have the handsome actor and entertainer Michael Vega coming. He's going to stand on my soapbox with me in our weekly rant, rave, and review show on pulp culture, LGBT news, and politics. So got a good week going on and all sorts of fun stuff. Of course, we got to talk a little bit about the Super Bowl and yesterday. If you're not sports ball fans, I'm right there with you guys. I know, but it was a good game at the end there. And got to give it to the Patriots. They had a huge comeback. But, of course, what everyone was interested in our LGBT world, of course, was Gaga and her halftime show. I thought she did an amazing job, probably one of the best in quite a few of the laughs that I can remember. Of course, just like any time, she's getting it from all sides. Of course, we have some people that are criticizing her for being too flagrant and open and sexual. And I guess that Alex Minister guy said she's from Satan, of course. And then even some of our own LGBT community, of course, saying, well, she wasn't really Gaga. She didn't really stand up. And then, well, she actually kind of did. If you want to look at what she did, I mean, a lot of people are talking about it today. She did some quiet activism that I think is really important. And it will really, I think, stand the test of time. She opened the song with God Bless America and This Land Is Your Land. And, of course, what you might not know, This Land Is Your Land is from Woody Guthrie. And one of the lines that was in the original song said there was a big high wall where they tried to stop me. The sign was painted, said private property. But on the backside, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me. How apropos is that? And for those of you that don't know it, Guthrie, I didn't even know this, but Guthrie wrote a protest song back in 1950 to take down Trump's father. He had leased an apartment from his dad in Brooklyn, Trump's dad, and was there for 2 years. He got really upset at the racist policies being carried out against blacks. That was all over the campaign. And so he wrote a protest song back then. One of the lines is, I suppose old man Trump knows just how much racial hate he stirred up in the blood spot of human hearts. When he drawed the colored line here at his 1800 family project. So actually, I think she did a lot of quiet activism, which is almost more important than having you blatantly out there. So good for her. Great performance. A lot of stuff we'll talk about at the end, but I believe we have Adam on the line, so I don't want to keep him here forever. Let's go ahead and find a quick song we can go ahead and play here and get him on the line. Guys, we're going to start with Nico. This is Two Hearts from Nico. You're listening to Left of Straight Show. When we come back, I'm going to have Adam Davenport as my special guest today. Be back in just a couple of moments. Nico out of New York. He's getting ready to tour and do his first show, and that's one of his first singles, Two Hearts. So we had him on the show a couple weeks back. Always check the app and you can check out that interview. But today, guys, I'm so excited to have our guest here. I can't think of a better way to celebrate Black History Month in today's divisive country, especially when it's all emanating from our national leadership. He grew up in one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country, but went on to graduate from Yale University, became an actor, a model, musical artist, producer, and writer. He was also recipient of the Panavision New Filmmaker Award, and at 26 years of age, he became the youngest member in the Playwright and Directors Unit of the Actors Studio. He is currently living in New York, where between acting projects, he's been creating some wonderful sounds in electronic dance music, including his new single, My Return Address Is You. So excited to have him on the show today. Please, everybody, welcome Adam Davenport. Adam, how are you today?
Oh, hey, Scott. I'm fantastic. And that was such a I'm so grateful to be on the show. So thank you so much. I'm just blushing.
Well, it's
my
pleasure to have you. Thanks so much for calling. I know you're down in Florida right now. You got a project going on down there. How's the weather in beautiful Florida?
Oh, it's 75 degrees. And, you know, any work outside of New York in the winter is a good excuse to get out of New York. So
I hear that. Well, I am so glad we had some time to talk to you today. I've listened to your new single. It's amazing. We're going to talk all about your music career in a little bit, but let's start in the beginning, go into a little bit of history on yourself and of your acting and writing and directing everything. Talk about growing up in life a little bit. I think you were born in Illinois, and we talked about you kind of in a poor neighborhood, but you had bullying and conversion therapy you went through, but really music helped you kind of get through it all. Talk about growing up in Illinois.
Sure. Well, I was born in Harvey, Illinois. That just that community itself is, I guess, an impoverished neighborhood. But I didn't grow up there. I grew up in Park Forest in Chicago Heights. And those are just working class suburban communities on the south side of Chicago. I went to Catholic school. And growing up in many years, I would sometimes only be the sole black kid in a class. It wasn't that unusual. I knew that I was gay at a pretty young age, and it's interesting how kids have seem to have intuition of your sexuality as well. So, you know, I was bullied. That's not that unusual for, you know, many young gay men to, you know, kind of be picked apart for being different. But I always found an escape through art. So for me, that escape was music, theater. I started doing plays my freshman year in high school, and I think I've always just tried to, I found expression for myself through those outlets.
Right. And now you talked about you were in a little bit of conversion therapy. Was your parents having trouble kind of accepting you, or was it maybe trouble where you figured you might have it black, bad enough being in the black community and gay on top of it? They wanted to kind of cure you from that. How was that journey for them?
Sure. Well, that happened in the summer of 1997. I was 13 years old. And what I will say is that the world was very different then than it is now.
Yeah.
And
right.
I don't blame my parents for – I actually have a much stronger relationship with my family than I've ever had in my life now just as a young man. And I think – really that choice to put me through conversion therapy was really just being a byproduct of that time. And, you know, we've come to an understanding and any healing about it. And, you know, I think if things could be repeated, I don't believe that the same actions would be taken. And I think if you look at in the last 20 years, our understanding, one would hope, of sexuality has evolved a lot more, although there are, you know, politically there are forces that want to reintroduce things like conversion therapy into the world. And I just have to tell you, as someone who went through that for a few months, it is just such a destructive force that negates the idea of someone knowing how to love themselves. So I will always be an advocate against that, because I think people should just be their authentic selves.
Right. Now, you kind of have the unique perspective. Like I said, it is Black History Month, and I'm so excited to be able to have you on one of my first guests in it. But you have – what did you feel kind of a different weight of being, like you said, you were the only Black kid in school, but you also had the gay thing on top of – did one kind of outweigh the other, or was it just like a double whammy, this sucks all of a sudden?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think they've always been present in me, but one thing I kind of – it's taken my whole life to understand this. I really just see myself as Adam over being, you know, gay or black. But I think when I was coming of age in Chicago, I think both of them – because I've been called the N-word and I've been called fag. And I think in some ways that the ways that I've been marginalized have just made me that much more determined to succeed and to to, they've made me more ambitious because I found that I had a voice through being creative. So in spite of someone trying to, you know, make me feel bad about myself, I found an outlet to heal from feeling bad about myself.
Well, that's awesome. And to go on about that point, I mean, talking about not holding back, at 15, you had a short story published, Home. It was acknowledged with an achievement award given by none other than President George Bush Sr. That's kind of exciting stuff.
Yeah, well, I've always, for me, any story, I see myself as a storyteller. And so I always have been a writer from a very early age. And that was the first thing I wrote that was published. And it kind of validated me in a sense that I realized in spite of people teasing me or cutting me down that I could, you know, create something that then would have, you know, impact or merit to get, you know, recognition like that. So it kind of, you know, I don't want to say it was, I think as an artist, you have a lot of different breakthroughs, not just like
right.
one thing that sets you off. But I think that was the first thing that made me realize that there was a possibility of my ideas, of generating ideas and putting them into the world and touching and impacting people. So
that is awesome. And then like I talked about in the intro, you went to Yale of all places. Congratulations. Graduated
Thanks.
From Yale, but you even started your own production company there, Bulldog Productions, because you saw the lack of opportunity for theater. And didn't you go there as like a communication or a literature major? How did the theater performance aspect of your career come about?
Sure. Well, I started as a literature major. Ended up graduating in film. That was kind of a roundabout path that led to that. It was sort of an accidental path, but I
gotcha.
Was a literature major for the first 3 years at Yale. And then I really at Yale, I kind of developed a love for the cinema. I started watching Woody Allen movies, and it was in college when I first was introduced to Meryl Streep's work, and I kind of became obsessed with her. And then like within a few weeks, watched every Meryl Streep movie I could get my hands on. But no, I became interested in the camera. And so I found that they have limited resources at the time for filmmaking at Yale. So I started a production company, Bulldog Productions, and we rented our equipment. Yale had some equipment, but a lot of the equipment we rented from outside, from like actual production companies and studios locally.
Gotcha.
And we would audition. It was interesting because it was a complete collaborative experience. The students would produce and direct these short films, but we would hire professional actors from New York City and do it under a SAG contract. And it was really just trying to do something that hadn't been done before. And I'm happy to say that now, 12 years later, that Bulldog Productions is still there and active at Yale. So it's really awesome just to feel that we left some kind of legacy, me and my friend Christian Clark, who co-founded it with me.
I can imagine. That is so cool. Well, talk about while you were a Yale undergraduate, your thesis project, you're 21 years old, and you create Midnight Sun, direct Midnight Sun. It garners you that Panavision New Filmmaker Award, who went on to people like Steven Soderbergh and Paul Thomas Anderson, two excellent directors we all know. And then you featured cinematography by one of Clint Eastwood's go-to guys and get an Academy Award-winning actress and mentor and eventually kind of surrogate mom for you, Melissa Leo. How did all that magic happen in a bottle?
Oh, man. I always start with a script. So I wrote this. For anyone who hasn't seen Midnight Sun, you can see it online. I believe it's on Vimeo. But
I recommend it highly.
And all I'll say is it's about a slice of life moment in a professor who leaves his wife one night to meet a stranger from the internet. That's all I'll say. But I knew that I wanted to make a professional quality short film. And the kind of story that that I wanted to make with Midnight Sun, I knew that it entailed working with actors of a certain skill level. I just love actors. So I think in my time at Yale as a film major, when I'd switched over my junior year, I was watching by that time two or three films a day. And so I first stumbled across Melissa Leo's work in 21 Grams. She played a small but pivotal supporting role as Benicio del Toro's wife. And I wrote her a cold letter because I did a little detective work because I knew that Hollywood agents weren't going to take me seriously and, you know, help me cast my project. So sometimes I find that the best way to reach out to someone is to find a direct avenue to them.
Right.
So she's listed to this day. She's listed in the phone book. So I wrote her a letter and sent her a letter, explaining what I wanted to do and why I liked her work. And she responded. And we had a conversation. And she agreed to do it. And then same thing with Tom Stern. I think I called the International Cinematographers Guild and said, "Hi, it's Adam Davenport. I need Tom Stern's number." And they gave me his direct number.
And I love it. Oh, my God.
And he called me back. And, you know, I'm very persistent with people. You know, even when I think initially he told me he didn't have time to do it because he was, you know, doing things with Clint Eastwood. And then I think I reapproached him a few months later, and then I had a coffee with him, and he took out a calendar and he said, "Well, if this is any help to you," he like highlighted 10 days in December. He's like, "This is when I can shoot your movie if this is a help to you." So, you know, I think with any film or theater project, it's not the result of one person's creativity. It's a collaboration. And I really love collaborating with people. So I think that was an early instance where I found that really worked out well.
That is so cool. And I found the same thing for my radio show. Honestly, I'm a nobody here. I mean, I was a huge fan of the entertainment world when I lived in LA, and I'd go to a lot of premieres and productions and watch movie thing. And my brother was an extra in a lot of things, but I just have a love of cinema. And when I started doing this radio show with something to do, it's like I went through people's Facebook pages and Instagram, and people actually talk to you. It's kind of amazing, and it's kind of a cool thing to be bold like that. So good on you for that, because I'm finding it working very well for me. That's how I got Margaret Cho, of all people, too. It was kind of cool.
Oh, wow. No, see, social media is great in that way of just connecting us like that, exactly.
It really is. I mean, it really is cool. Now, talk a little more about Melissa. I mean, she went on not only to do this film, but she kind of, like I said, became like a surrogate mom and really kind of helped you along. You were there during the entire Golden Globe and Oscar thing for The Fighter, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, the story there is after we shot Midnight Sun, we became very close to the point we were in very frequent contact, talking a couple of times a week. And after I graduated from college, she shot Frozen River. And she called me one day and said, "Hey, I just did this movie, and I think it's going to do something for me. And I'm going to just taking a leap of faith." She rented a house in LA, and she'd never lived in LA before, but she recognized that this was the time in her career to, you know, try to have more of a Hollywood presence. And so she asked me if I wanted to be her roommate. And by that time, I didn't know her that well. I mean, because we really had just the only time we had spent together was on set in person. So I was thinking to myself, older actress asking me to live with her. Well, this could turn out to be like Sunset Boulevard, but why not?
You're definitely a handsome young man. I don't blame her for that part if that happened, but sure. Go ahead.
So, I accepted her invitation, and we rented the house together. I subletted a room from her, and I lived there for 3 years. So she's brought me to the Oscars both times she was nominated, Frozen River and Fighter. And, you know, I think for those award campaigns too, especially Frozen River, there wasn't a lot of money from the distributor to put into her campaign. So we kind of just on our own did this very grassroots campaign to get people to see the film, and you know, other actors became very supportive of her and Frozen River, like Sally Kirkland. And I really just see that as artists, we just kind of have to come together and help each other. And I really have learned that firsthand from her. I definitely consider her, you know, like a second mom to me. And she really has taught me over the last 10 years to learn how to love myself and to be, you know, to just be really serious about the work. She's not interested in celebrity. She just, from each project, just does her work. And I think she's modeled that behavior in myself. I mean, at least that's what I'm trying to do now with my own career. So she's a great mentor and role model.
That is fantastic. And those listeners don't know who we're talking about, you need to look her up. Melissa Leo, I mean, the fighter was Christian Bale and Mark Wahlberg. I mean, she won against Amy Adams that tries to win almost everything she does. I mean, she's just an amazing actress. So that is so cool. That's a great story. Now talk a little bit about, 26 years old, you're accepted into the director's unit at the acting studio. Your interviews with Martin Landau and Mark Rydell, who I love, Martin Landau. What was that all about? How exciting was that?
Well, I had been in LA for a few years by that time, and I was looking for an avenue where I could continue developing my, I guess, instrument as a director. Because, and particularly, there's not a lot of, there is theater in LA, but not to the extent that there is in New York City. So right. I was looking to be part of a community where I could still have one foot in that. And Melissa suggests that I, apply to the studio, because they have this unit where they foster new work with playwrights and directors. So I sent an application, and by this time I was just sort of informally on my own doing play readings in my living room, because I love theater so much. In my mind, I'm like, well, if I don't have access to a theater, but I know all these actors, why don't I just call them up on a Friday night and see what they're doing, and we'll come over and work on some really great plays for a few hours. So by the time
I applied
to the studio, I had already worked with, I had done a couple of readings with Alfred Woodard, and I had done a reading with Lawrence Fishburne and Terrence Howard. And so I became really comfortable, I think, just by putting myself out there. And listen, I'm not telling you the people that have told me no, that said no to me, but a lot of people did say yes if it worked out for their schedule. They were interested in what I was trying to do. So by the time I had applied to the studio, I was very comfortable working, communicating with actors. And so they admitted me, and I've staged a couple of readings of new plays at the Actors Studio. I just did one most recently in New York, a John Albanese play that Chaz Palminteri moderated. And so grateful. The studio's really let me keep one foot in the theater world consistently ever since I got in. So it's a great community, and I think the Actors Studio has a lot of history behind it. I think of when you go in that building, you're like, my God, James Dean and Marlon Brando were sitting where I am right now. So it makes you take what you're doing a whole lot more seriously. And just to be humble about it too, there's not really any room for ego, because there's so many, many important artists that came there before you.
Yeah, just a lot of talent, right? Wow. That is so cool. So you spent about 8 years in LA, then you eventually moved to New York. You had a stage debut with Bonfire of the Vanities. You've been directed by Olympia Dukakis, who I love. You'll be working on a project executive produced by Spike Lee later in the year. But I really want to talk about all that, but especially you played Hercules, one of the first, probably the first LGBT person to take it on, and probably the first African-American to play the part. How was that to play that role?
Wow. Well, so I saw the breakdown for that, and I'm someone who I'll audition for anything that will see me. Because even if I'm not I don't think I'm right for it. I see going to auditions like going to the gym. And if you're an actor, you need to be acting like every day. So that's kind of become my attitude about auditions. So when that project, Project Olympus, came up, it was very interesting because it's a musical feature. They take the mythology of the Greek gods and they set it in outer space. So when I'm looking at the breakdown for this, I'm like, this sounds like incredible. Like, I've never seen anything like this before. And you know, there's so many great singers in New York City. I'm like, well, whatever. I wasn't in great vocal health when I went in for my audition. I think I was just getting over bronchitis. So I went in, I had prepared the song, and I figured, well, my voice is a little limited today. I'm going to really just try to focus on my acting and what is the story of the song. So there was a part where, you know, like sometimes when you're in a musical audition and there's like a 8 bars where there's just music and you're just up there standing and like, oh, hi, right. I'm pretty. I just started ad-libbing as Hercules. I started talking about why my father Zeus annoyed me because he's always sleeping with these mortal women, and it's embarrassing to find out that you have all these half sisters, you know, running around. So,
amazing! Oh my God!
Yeah, so I just started rambling, and but then I didn't hear anything from him. So I was like, oh, I guess they didn't like that. And then a month later, they offered me the job, and that was my first feature that I shot. And we shot it on green. Oh, the whole movie is filmed on green screen. So it's in post now, and I'm excited to see what they do with it.
That's awesome. Wow, that is so cool. All right, let's get a little transition here. I want to go ahead and play your single, My Return Address Is You. Love the song. I love the dance music to it. Let's go ahead and take a break and play this. We'll come back on the other side and talk all about this new music venue you're going into. We're talking to Adam Davenport. You're listening to the Left of Straight Show. We'll be back in just a couple of moments. we are back. That is my special guest today, Adam Davenport, with his newest single, My Return Address Is You. Adam, fantastic. I love the lyrics. I love the sound. Congratulations, man.
Oh, thank you. It's such a dream. It's my, you know, for a first song to have traction like that. So beyond my wildest dreams. So I just hope to continue, you know, with each track to do something different. So
that is awesome. Especially as an artist, I can understand how exciting that could be just to grow. To use that. What was your music influence? What were you listening to as a kid? And what were your early music influences back in the day?
I really love great songwriting, and I've typically loved anything with great vocals and with a beat. So it's everything from Earth, Wind, and Fire, anything from Quincy Jones, classic. I listen to a lot of classic rock. I think when I started working on this track, I was listening to, you know, everything from like Giorgio Moroder to Morgan Page, and you know, of course, nice. Someone like Calvin Harris is always a fantastic producer. I just kind of would live with sound in my ear.
That is awesome. Now, what are your thoughts on dance music? I mean, I kind of read your bio and you kind of came from the same field I am. It seems like dance music really got real popular in the LGBT clubs and the early black clubs, but it's kind of been almost a little swiped today. What draws you to dance music, and what is your feelings on the genre right now?
Well, the appeal of dance music for me, one of them is that on the dance floor, everyone's welcome, irrespective of any, what their background is or gender, ethnicity, race, or religious creed. And I think I've noticed that whether it's at a gay club or at a music festival, on the floor, I just see kind of everyone's moving together in unison to a single beat. And I've never seen such joy like at some of those festivals. And I think too, dance music makes you, it chemically, it gives you, it makes you feel good. You know, everyone wants to be lifted up. And I think especially in times like these that are troubling, we need to have an avenue to escape and an avenue to come together. And for me, that's where dance music started when I was, you know, a lonely kid, 13 years old in Chicago. I got a lot of solace from Earth, Wind, and Fire, Stevie Wonder, Janet Jackson. And so I think it's this first track for me was kind of there's a little bit of nostalgia in the production, and it's kind of a throwback to that time of my life. And I think in terms that address your other question about dance music, you know, I think what's interesting is that the roots of electronic dance music really come from house and disco music, which are really representative of the black and gay communities. I mean, there was house music was invented by a gay black man in Chicago who created this club called The Warehouse, and that's where the music originated. His name is Frankie Knuckles. But now if you look at EDM or electronic dance music, it's become a little bit homogenous, and, you know, dominated by, I'd say, and it's no fault on these producers, but largely a lot of the artists are straight white DJ producers. And so it's interesting how it's shifted away from the roots of where this music came from.
Right.
So that's something, I mean, that's something that one can think about. I don't really know what the answer is other than to just make music.
And your track's getting remixed by some pretty popular folks too, right?
Oh yeah. It's become a whole international party. I've got a Stonebridge. He's a Grammy nominated producer out of Sweden who just turned in his remix, which we'll be releasing in the next week, probably in time for Valentine's Day. And then, Alias, he's a very talented, producer out of Australia. and Jordan Jay. He's a Dutch producer who I guess you could say he's a protege of like David Guetta and Nicky Romero. He just turned in a remix for me as well. And I have an artist out of Italy doing a remix for me as well. A friend of mine who I used to know in LA, who's now his DJ career has taken off in Italy. So, yeah, it's really exciting that once again goes back to that conversation about collaboration.
Right.
The idea that creating one thing and now it's exciting to share the stems with other really talented artists, and then they do their take on the track, and they send it back to you, and they've completely reinvented the song, and it has a different vibe and flavor and atmosphere to it. I think that's why remixes are really powerful to me.
Right, that's amazing. And then talk about collaborations. You're working with Shanika Knowles on this, who's actually a country artist. She has a pretty well known cousin, I believe. But how did that collaboration come about?
Oh, Shanika. The thing with Shanika is I found her on social media. One day, how did that happen? She liked one of my posts, and I lately have been paying attention to everyone that you know, because you never know who sees what you put out there in the universe. And I've always been curious, you know, when you put something out there, what kind of outreach or impact it has. So I was like, Shanika Knowles, who is this? And so I did my research, and I found that she had a really interesting sound. And so when I was working on kind of conceptually my Return Address Is You, who I was working with Leslie Mills, who is a Nashville-based songwriter. So I thought, this could be the perfect marriage, because I wanted to find a singer that was going to have a different vibe than the kind of singers that are on a dance track right now. And there's something very soulful, but also, like I said, a throwback to that time in, like, let's say folk music, like, or even like the 80s kind of tinged pop music, like Stevie Nicks and Fleetwood Mac. Right. And I know that Shanika herself is inspired by like Dido and Alanis Morissette. And so I thought it was the perfect match for the song. So I pitched it to her, and she loved it, and she recorded it in a few hours in LA. And she sang all the harmonies, because there's a lot of harmonies. There's actually way more harmonies in the song that we recorded than we used. But she's very talented.
That is so cool. Well, I'm so excited for you. Do you have any plans? Do you have your first date to play this anywhere yet, or are you still just kind of feeling everything out and creating some more music, or what's your next steps here?
Well, I've just been so busy. I'm doing this play in Fort Lauderdale through the middle of March, and there may be some live performances on the horizon. I think for me a priority would be getting back into the studio and producing some more tracks, and I've already kind of outlined what those could look like. I always start with lyrics, because I, like I said, being a storyteller, I kind of want to know what I'm saying with the song.
Right.
And then I go from there, you know, to the melody, and then working on producing the track. So all I can tell you is that the next track will be completely different from this one. This one's kind of like electro pop. There's a lot of pop in it, pop folk. But the next track will be very different, probably a deeper house sound. But, of course, throwing on some other things that make it, you know, original. So
nice. And this single is available right now on Amazon and iTunes, of course. Tell them where they can find the single, and give everyone your social media so they can follow you, because you just have such an amazing and fascinating life, my friend. I can't wait to get to know you more.
Oh, thanks. Yes, you can go on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, Tidal, Amazon Music, Google Play. It's there waiting for you to open your heart. And let me know.
Do you have any social media we can follow you at?
I'm on Facebook and Instagram, Adam Davenport, NYC.
Awesome blossom. Well, my friend, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. do you happen to be in the Fort Lauderdale area? Where's your play showing at? What play? What's it called?
So I'm in Ronnie Larson's play. It's called Shooting Porn. It's at the Empire Stage. It's based on a documentary that Ronnie made that was very well reviewed by Variety and a bunch of other outlets, where he made a documentary about the inner workings of the adult film industry in the 90s. And so he decided to adapt this documentary that played at all the gay and lesbian festivals internationally. It did very well. It then got distribution.
It was a huge success. I remember it well,
yeah. Yeah, and so he's taken that documentary and reshaped it into a theater piece. And it's really interesting. He's got one actor with a live camera that's filming us on the stage. And the images are projected onto a big screen. It's almost like there's this director right now who's very popular on Broadway, Ivan Van Hove. It's almost like Ivan Van Hove's early work. But yeah,
wow.
So there's parts of it that are the show is funny, but the way he's staging it definitely has elements of avant-garde theater in it. So it is true theater. And yeah, it's my first time working outside of New York City for more than a few days. So, we have 6 shows a week. And so if you're in South Florida, come see the show and,
you know,
I think you'll laugh.
Called?
What's that?
Do you know the name of the theater?
Oh, the theater, the Empire Stage.
Oh, okay. Great. Super duper. Well, Adam, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being left a straight show today.
Oh, thank you. I had a great time, and thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Stay on the line for me. We'll talk a little more off air in just a second. Guys, you're listening to Left of Straight Show. I want to thank our guest, Adam Davenport. Please go to Spotify, iTunes, get the single. Again, it's called My Return Addresses You. Fantastic work. When you're listening to Left of Straight Show, we'll be back in just a couple of moments. Here's our good friend, Trevor Page, with American Dream.
Just the way.
are back. That was Trevor Page with American Dream. Big thanks to actor, model, and music artist Adam Davenport for coming on the show today. He is a really smart and dedicated guy, guys. You need to follow him, follow his career. He is just awesome. Let's see what we got going on. Again, tomorrow we'll be back here for another Left of Straight show, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern time. Have two guests tomorrow. I'm bringing on one of my favorite buddies, trans activist Scott Turner Schofield. He's actually also in Florida this week. He's doing a residency in Florida for the week, bringing his one-man show, How to Be a Man in 127 Easy Steps, to the Miami-Dade University campus there. And he's going to do a couple master classes down there. So we're going to talk to him tomorrow, and then I'm going to bring back singer Preston Wiggins, has a new music release as well. So great show tomorrow. Wednesday, we'll be standing on my soapbox. We'll be talking about current events with actor, entertainer Michael Vega. Things on the subject, I think we're going to talk about a new gay Doctor Who, possibly, the new Drag Race cast, the Grammys coming up this weekend with James Corden, the Stonewall protest this past weekend. Of course, there'll be lots of politics to talk about. Now, remember, every Wednesday is your call-in show to tell us what's on your mind or to join my special guest and I as we talk about these different subjects. And it's a call-in show you can listen to or call in live to. So that is Wednesday. And then this Saturday on Voices for Change 2.0, which is my buddy Rebecca and Joe Lombardo, our straight allies that do their mental health show, they are bringing on their show WWE champion Diamond Dallas Page. Believe it or not, he's now doing kind of an extreme yoga thing, but he's going to be on their show this Saturday. So great week of LGBT radio for LGBT and ally radio. So that's happening. I'm excited that I got my two graphic novels to Daylight Sucks. If you listened to the show last week, Katie Barberi and Craig Hurley have put this graphic novel together about these vengeful vampires that only take it out on bad guys. And they have a vampire dedicated to equality and LGBT rights. A vampire gets upset with animal rights and with the planet. And these guys are vigilante vampires. It's a gorgeous looking book. So you really have to see that, and it's just amazing. But guys, I appreciate you tuning in today. We've had a great show. Again, a big shout out and thank you to Adam Davenport. We'll see you tomorrow here, same time, same place, right here on Blog Talk Radio, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern time. Thanks for listening to the Left of Straight show. This is Scott Fullerton, and I'm out of here.